Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm joined today by Hans Gersbach, author of Redesigning Democracy, More Ideas for Better Rules, published by Springer. Now, this is not a new book as such. It was published in 2017, and as the subtitle suggests, it was a development of ideas already floated in the author's 2005 book, Designing Democracy. But just because a new edition hasn't been published in 4 years doesn't mean the author hasn't been churning out his own updates. Together with collaborators, he has published papers on, among other things, the optimal length of political terms, using re-election thresholds to curb political polarization, pendular voting and vote delegation, semi-flexible majority rules for public good provision, incentive pay for policymakers, and politsplaining. For 3 decades, Professor Gersbach has been using economic analysis and tools to explain and improve political behavior. When he started out, we were meant to be at the end of history. Liberal democracy had won. Today, things look rather different, and his mission to optimize democracy and reduce the disenchantment that feeds extremism has never been more salient. Hans Gersbach holds the chair of macroeconomics, innovation, and policy at ETH Zurich, and previously taught at Heidelberg and Basel. Hans, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Before we explore some of the ideas in your book and the follow-up papers I mentioned, can we go right back to the beginning, to the late 80s, the early 90s, and how you got into this unusual area of economics?
Yes. Actually, my interest started when I was a teenager and looked at how direct democracy was working in our village here in Switzerland. And I saw strengths, but also fragilities of such democratic governance. Overall, it went well, and I was quite satisfied, actually, with how democracy was working. But then in the 80s and 90s, I was confronted with the public choice school, founded by Buchanan and Tullock, and saw how economic analysis, political economy, identified many, many shortcomings of democracies. And also noticed that, while liberal democracies are some of the best system of self-governance for societies, they rarely invoke great enthusiasm among even among scientists and among citizens. So I started to think about, can we improve democracy? And then quite a lot of ideas came up, and over time, more and more ideas came up, and that convinced me that we can improve democracy. And there are many, many ideas out there that we simply need to find, to develop, and obviously to assess whether or not, obviously, there really are improvements for democracy.
And for listeners who don't know the economic intellectual history, could you take us through what public choice is and who Buchanan and Tullock were?
Yeah, Buchanan and Tullock actually started in the 60s to challenge a view that was prevailing that politicians are motivated simply by improving the well-being of citizens. They assumed that politicians have their own objectives when they come into power, and they may pursue policies that may not be in the interest of citizens, because those policies may foster their own well-being in particular ways, or may foster the well-being of particular interest groups, and also challenge some of the decisions, the decision-making procedure that may not go go well. In parallel, there was already, of course, a lot of skepticism in the so-called social choice literature about whether or not collective decision-making will always produce good results. So that was already there. But then Buchanan and Tullock took it actually, this critical view, to a much more different level by exactly challenging the motivations of politicians and the outcomes that may come about this. And then a whole school emerged actually and identified a lot of deficiencies that we see in democracies. And that was actually the starting point actually of my endeavor.
Mm. Is it still a much more dominant school in the US than Europe, or has it become – I sometimes think it's become quite tangled up with what used to be known as ordo-liberalism in Europe, and the two have created this sort of synthesis. Is it bigger in the US or over here?
Yeah, I think that – the assumption that also politicians have their own objectives is very widely now acknowledged and accepted in the much wider profession, but people don't call themselves anymore public choice scholars. They're doing political economy. They analyze economic political systems. So that assumption basically that is widely accepted, but the school as such has certainly has not this dominance it had once actually as an own school, because simply people now doing political economic analysis, but don't call themselves as a part of a school anymore.
Mm. Well, what really struck me was reading the book and your papers. I mean, we're talking about concepts like optimizing democracy or making it more efficient and so on. But having read it, I thought of one central principle, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. We don't like politicians to lie outright, but we don't expect them to be entirely honest, especially during campaigns when they set out their prospectus. And yet we wouldn't accept this in any other area of life. So you're trying to build in rewards and consequences that converge politics with the rest of life. Do you think that's an accurate way of seeing your research project?
I think this is one part of the research project, is to introduce political contracts and to turn democracy into the so-called contractual democracy, in which politicians can choose when they want to make promises to citizens. They can still make some vague promises that may, see at the end, not turn out to be or will not be fulfilled at the end. But they can also select a subset of promises against which they are charged harder, because there are consequences if they don't fulfill those promises. Of course, those promises need to qualify in a certain way, actually, to be connected to rewards or to punishment, because they need to be certified and they need to be precise. I would like to allow politicians actually promises that against or for which they are much harder charged, and those promises are linked to rewards or punishments, and others that are standard promises, sometimes exactly they are not honest about them, or that they are very vague, and they always are true or not cannot be judged to be untrue exactly. So but politicians have the choice to select those two subsets exactly. But we should open a set of rules, actually, to allow politicians to make also this other subset, namely the certified promises in which rewards and punishments are attached.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get down to some of the proposals in some detail, and let's start with your idea of a coalition preclusion contract. Can you talk us through this idea, precisely how it would work and what they are meant to achieve?
Exactly. So we had in many instances politicians who promised not to engage in a coalition with a particular other party, typically extreme parties, at least parties that were viewed as extremes. We had such cases in Germany, for instance, famous cases. And then politicians exactly said, we will never enter into a coalition with that party. But after the election was over, and a coalition with that party was nevertheless now all of a sudden attractive to come into power, then politicians have broken that promise. And the coalition preclusion contract simply means if a politician wants to be serious about not entering into a coalition or a party at the end with politicians running for office, want to be serious and want to be at the end commit not to enter into a coalition with another party, they can make such a promise that is then certified. And if they then nevertheless would enter into a coalition, they would get severely punished. Either they would lose all public funding for their party, and if the punishment is sufficiently severe, then they would not renege on their promise. So that opens for citizens the possibility that indeed such promises have bite and will not be, and they will and parties will not renege on them after it, and that will help citizens to make much more informed election choices when it comes then exactly to elections.
Yeah, and you mentioned that they should be certified promises. Who do those certificate? Who ensures that certification? Where is it? Where is that lodged?
Exactly. So that's an important, obviously, question, because obviously there has to be a formal process, a legal process at the end, in which parties certify their promises they want to certify. They are obviously free which ones they want to certify. That's a choice of politicians and parties at the end. So a certification body should be an independent body. It could be obviously, and should be in the judicial branch, and should be an independent body that certifies those promises, and also then at the end judges whether it has been violated or not.
In some countries, would it be appropriate I think of countries like Ireland or Italy, where you have these heads of state that have these government formation responsibilities, would it make sense for the president in that case to be the certification body or the office of the president?
Exactly. That is an idea. I also talked about this idea with legal scholars, actually, and there are pros and cons about this solution. But that would be the easiest solution in some sense, that you don't need a new institution to introduce for certification. Exactly. But they would need to have a body actually touching that, etc. But ultimately, that would be the easiest way actually to introduce this within the existing branches we have.
Now, I can imagine people's problem with this model, which is that it potentially leads to Syriza or Five Star or even Trump, in that if you have a system that encourages the formation of grand coalitions, when you have multi-party systems, those parties that would otherwise be seen as opposition are seen as part of the establishment, and you lose that sort of political safety valve and in some ways encourage extremism. How would you argue against that?
Exactly. So one important component is that one party should only be allowed to exclude one other party. Otherwise, it could get, you see, at the end, the difficulties in forming governments at the end. So that is one problem. And the second problem, indeed, it can actually foster grand coalitions. But typically what our research shows and the analysis shows, parties will only exclude extreme parties of the extreme parties in the political spectrum in those coalition preclusion contracts. And then at the end, we have a choice between a grand coalition and a coalition with an extreme party. And typically a grand coalition then dominates nevertheless, even if it's a grand coalition, the outcome of having a party or a coalition of a party with another extreme party. So that's still better at the end for citizens as a whole, mm-hmm. on average for citizens, having that exactly outcome. But in many cases, what coalition preclusion contracts help actually is that a single party actually gets more votes and can form actually a government with another small party or even on its own. So it can mm-hmm. also prevent in many, many cases grand coalitions simply because voters coordinate their votes on a particular party much more than they do it without this coalition preclusion contract, because then citizens do not know with whom this party will make a coalition and are careful. And otherwise, mm-hmm. they are sure there will be no coalition with an extreme party, and then they will coordinate much more on conventional votes on conventional parties and may help one of them having a majority or a majority of another small party.
I guess the other thing it might do over time would be to force parts of the extreme parties into one of the established parties, so you'd end up with these mega parties like exist in France or the UK or United States that are made up of anything from the center to the extreme. Do you think that would be a possible outcome also?
Absolutely. So a possible outcome is also that extreme parties actually become smaller and some of the ideas actually are taken up, and therefore also some citizens are taken up by conventional parties. Typically, such a process is healthy for the democracy, of course, only as long as obviously ideas are taken up that are not connected to violence or other, you see, very unpleasant things. Because then you see they are taken up, they are weakened, they are putting into a compromise solutions, and that is then part of somehow consensus formation and also increasing the social fabric actually in a democracy and makes the democracy more stable and more inclusive. And that's actually another advantage of such devices.
Well, these preclusion contracts are quite specific to proportional representation systems where coalitions are necessary to form governments. Yes. You've also addressed the opposite problem in the UK and the US, which is safe seats, long incumbencies. Yeah. So, and one of your ideas is really interesting idea of a history-bound re-election. Can you explain this idea?
Exactly. So it's a very simple idea in principle. They're saying, okay, if you are running now for a seat, and for instance, in the U.S. House of Representatives, if you, for instance, if you start running for the first, if you are nominated by your party and you are winning this seat, say by 60%, because a very safe seat for your party, many, many seats are safe. You see, the vast majority of seats in the US are safe. Then the next time you are running again for re-election, you must replicate the score you had previously, actually. So that would mean here in extreme case, 60%, but in a weaker form, it would be a little bit less, say, for instance, 55%. So you need to then replicate a higher score that is, and the higher score is based on your previous election results. And that means that you are not automatically always winning. You see the next elections again, that the competition is much more competitive. And that also has then positive effects typically on how parties select politicians in such districts, because they are select a little bit more moderate candidates, because they can always win, you see, a larger share of the votes. And therefore, history-bound re-elections exactly have or promise to have quite a lot of advantages. Exactly one I already said, it's just more moderate people are elected. So there's less polarization then in parliament. And therefore, consensus compromises are easier actually to achieve. Moreover, the motivation actually for the politicians to behave in a good way are higher, because it's always a little bit under the threat of deselection. And typically the threat of deselection is one, obviously, the threat and accountability device we have in a democracy to foster good behavior of politicians. So that is then the second advantage. And the third advantage, there's simply more turnover over time, and therefore also new people can come in. And we don't see then, you see, that people are in office for 30 years or something like that, simply because the seat is safe.
Yeah, I mean, you also look into that regarding the perils of incumbency. You did a paper with Matthew Jackson and Oriel Tejada on optimal term length. What did you conclude from that?
Exactly. So we developed a framework actually to analyze and identify what are optimal term lengths actually for a political environment, depending on the characteristics of the democracy exactly. And there we found out that the term length depends on a particular set of characteristics. And depending on what you are looking for now, in the US, for instance, House of Representatives, the Senate, or the Supreme Court, you come to different conclusions about what is the optimal term length exactly. And we also have seen, for instance, as an example, if polarization increases in society, as we have seen, for instance, in the US, in particular political polarization, then it might be actually good not to have too short term. So the term length should not be too short. And therefore, for instance, the term length in the House of Representatives with 2 years appears to be quite short, or one could even go a little bit further and say it's actually probably too short, simply because when you have such short terms and there's large political polarization, then when you have a change in the House of Representatives, you have large policy swings, you have large adjustment costs that are occurring. And that is, in some sense, inefficient. If those see large change on the adjustment costs of policies occur too frequently. Moreover, also people need to obviously to engage in campaigns. You see a lot of time, you see, they are actually in parliament. And therefore, obviously, that is also something that has to be fostered in addition to costs of organizing elections, et cetera. So additional cost elements as well.
Yeah, two-year term is a permanent campaign, effectively. I mean, do you conclude what is a optimal average term? Should it be four or 5 years, for example?
Exactly. So I should be careful. I think we have done a theoretical analysis on the determinants of terms. And our analysis shows that if there's more polarization, like in the US over the last decades, you should increase the term length. So that suggests that the term length in the House of Representatives is probably might be too short. But we have not done an empirical analysis proving this. I think we want to be very careful here. It comes out of our theoretical model and the determinants we are looking at and the comparative statistics we are doing, but we have not a proof, an empirical one. You see that it is too short. I want to be very, very careful here. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have not done, cannot say, 4 years is the correct one and 3 years is the wrong one. I think that we cannot do and do not want to do. But we can say if certain developments happening, should we increase the term? Should it be lower? Should it be higher in a court than in the Senate? And the Senate should be higher. The term length in the Senate should be higher than in the House. Can this be rationalized? All those things we can do exactly, but not precise term lengths. We cannot, and or be careful actually not to want to say that we can calculate directly optimal term lengths, but the relationships and how developments impact term lengths we can do.
I've got a last question on political accountability, and this could be your Swissness coming through here, but you have this idea for assessment or sample voting to test public opinion before big parliamentary decisions. Now, as I understand it, this could actually form part of the ultimate decision. Can you explain this idea?
Exactly. It's also a very simple idea. If you have a direct democracy like in Switzerland, but also in California, and you have usually a lot of initiatives to see people should vote on it, then you could do the following. Your first sample, a subset of citizens eligible to vote. So for instance, Switzerland could be 100,000, California maybe obviously a little bit larger, 500,000 or a million. And then you let them, so they are randomly selected, and they get all the information, and they have now, they obtain also the right to vote on a particular initiative. Once they have voted on this initiative, the results is published. And then we could allow that the guys or the people who have exactly created this initiative actually to withdraw the initiative if they see, well, the result is overwhelmingly against to see this initiative. Mm. There's no sense to go to a full campaign. Or they can go or say, no, we want to have a full vote. And then in a second round, exactly the rest of the citizens would vote because, of course, we have one person, one vote. So everybody has the right to vote. And if something is implemented, as a change is implemented, everybody has the right to needs to have the right to vote, of course, because I'm a personal vote, and then the rest is voting. But even there, we could see then that participation in the second round of voting is very low because if the result is already clear, then people will not bother a lot and simply say, well, the result is already clear, and then the second vote would simply confirm the first vote. If it's tighter, of course, then not, then we have a full campaign, obviously also in the second round. So at the end, it would allow, you see, that we can have more initiatives, more proposals people vote on, but we don't need to actually always to go immediately to the full-blown vote of all citizens, exactly.
So this is really to save the time and cost of a general referendum, is that right?
Exactly. In addition, there are now new ideas actually where in the pendular voting case where we say, well, suppose an initiative group brings up a proposal, the first round gives a particular result that is overwhelmingly against it, then we could allow the initiative group actually to adjust their proposal and to make a better one actually. And then having obviously then having later on a full vote on everybody. So it could also help to improve proposals by initiative groups before you see the full, all citizens have to vote on it exactly.
Is this something that could be applied also to parliamentary decisions, a very difficult parliamentary reform where you would be able to test it against public opinion? Or is this... Do you think this would only be something specific to referendums?
No. I think it has much wider applications. The one you just mentioned exactly would be a good one exactly also to do it. You can do it in very large committees. And you can do it also, and I think that could also be a major application on blockchains. You see, blockchains today, they need a governance system. And they have a huge amount maybe of participants, maybe not that interested in voting or to participate. There also you could randomly select a subset of participants and then let them vote. So they're exactly, we think that assessment voting have a lot of applications in various areas in democracy, but also in other somehow virtual societies like blockchains.
Moving away from accountability and back to mechanisms designed to protect the system and institution from politicians, your idea of catenarian fiscal discipline is really interesting and heterodox. Again, can you talk us through this idea, how it would work?
Yeah, obviously, I would also like to say, you see, that I think created or came up with a lot of ideas, and analyzing them, look into the pros and cons. But it does not mean that if I have an idea, see, I immediately say this has to be implemented. You see,
no.
So many, many ideas I think I've produced are exactly analyzed, etc. Some I will propose at the end to be implemented. A variant of history-bound re-election, for instance, would certainly be a good thing to do, to experiment with that. But there has a lot of analysis have to go into, you see, before and examining robustness, feedback effects, unintended consequences have to go into a proposal until we can make a judgment and say we should implement it, only as a cautious statement on the ideas. But that is the catenarian discipline or fiscal discipline would be another very interesting rule to say, because we are, exactly, many countries have difficulties exactly in getting, in sustaining fiscal discipline. And one idea would be to say, so if a government is fiscally disciplined, they can impose, at least in the first half of the term of the next government, or if it's another government, they can impose discipline, fiscal discipline. That means the budget deficit cannot go above a certain level, for instance, as a percentage of GDP. They can impose certain disciplines in the first half of the term of the next government. So the next government is not free, actually, on fiscal discipline in this first half of the term. And in the second half of the term of the next government can then, you see, choose whatever they want in terms of fiscal situation, so on budget deficit and debt levels. But then if they are again disciplined, they have the right to impose the discipline on the next government as well. If they are not disciplined themselves, then they lose that right. And that creates incentives also for the next government maybe to remain disciplined, because then they can impose that also on the next government. On the first half of their term, and that creates a chain between governments, and ideally, then that fiscal discipline induces fiscal discipline along the chain, and every government then all of a sudden says it's in its interest actually to remain disciplined, because they can impose it on the next generation. Because typically the problem is if one government is disciplined and the next one is not, then see all the benefits from fiscal discipline of the previous government get somehow lost, because it has no long-term benefits. And therefore, a government can ensure that the long-term benefits of fiscal discipline will be sustained through this chain rights of imposing disciplines on the next government.
Well, this idea made me think more widely about the idea of the sharing of pain between parties, and a quote from the historian Neil Ferguson, who said a few years ago, he said, "Public debt allows the current generation of voters to live at the expense of those yet to be too young to vote or is yet unborn." And could you imagine a rule or institutional design to address this? For example, a rule that each parliamentary term is bound to pass one painful reform, you know, that's spread across the parties to address a long-term problem, or some kind of structure or institution to represent people who cannot vote yet or generations that don't exist yet?
Absolutely. So I have actually earlier papers, actually 15 years ago, actually papers that are now actually are revived and actually will be added actually to this whole set of ideas, in which we have institutions that, for instance, that allow exactly such type of problems to be solved. The simplest idea, for instance, would be suppose you have a very painful reform that mainly has to be born by the current generation, and they are against that exactly. Then you could still have a vote on that, but you then distinguish the votes in terms of, for instance, colors if it's paper, whether you get the vote from the people, you see, the older generation or the younger generation. And if you get the approval of the younger generation, actually, who are in favor of this reform because they will benefit them in the long term, then, for instance, a politician gets a reward. So that's a simple idea, actually. He may still lose, but he still gets a reward, and therefore he may be willing to do much more, actually, in this direction, actually, even if he has, at the moment, a majority in the current generations against it. More dramatic, obviously, and more provocative, exactly, are proposals that go in the direction to limit, actually, exactly, painful reforms, actually, in terms of the numbers, as you have alluded to that, or having catenarian discipline, exactly, in other ways, and benefiting, for instance, politicians in the long term. For instance, his pension, you see, could be connected actually to painful reform he has done earlier. So exactly, so long-term incentives actually for politicians is one of the very, very important exactly areas to work on.
You mentioned the politician would be rewarded. What kind of rewards are we talking about here?
Well, the reward, of course, they're typically the monetary rewards, but there are also rewards in other ways, actually, because politicians like to, obviously, money is important, but they like to be a career, status, etc. So, for instance, one could, one of the proposals is to form a body of elder statesmen, an official body, not only as an informal, an official body of elder statesmen, actually, to which politicians can qualify exactly to such type of proposals if they get, for instance, approval of a certain group or to do painful reforms. And then they are, for instance, a group that will judge reforms in the future. They have no decision power anymore, but the official body is actually in society to judge, you see, whether reforms have long-term good consequences or not. And that will influence then public certainly opinion, hopefully, and there will be somehow always a judgment added actually by such a body, and politicians can qualify for such bodies through good actions, good policies, long-term policies. So there are a lot of ideas how to do this reward, money or not money, and one has to think about what are the best ones exactly.
Yeah. Well, as we've alluded to here, you've done a lot of thinking and a lot of proposing since the book came out. Are you going to consolidate this into another book soon?
Well, surprisingly, I thought actually with the second book, I have reached a certain level. But in recent times, there are so many new ideas came up. Assessment voting, co-voting, and new pendular voting. There are so many new ideas there. So we certainly will now do a lot of research in the next years to come, or we are already doing a lot of research and bringing those proposals to analytical analysis, and then exactly over time, if everything goes well, I will currently come up with a third book, actually, because many new ideas have sprung in recent times. And I'm actually a little bit myself, not overwhelmed, but I see many ideas. They have to be analyzed, and there are new things that should be done exactly. So I assume so there will be a third book.
So that we'll have redesigning democracy next.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. To finish, as usual, because this is a podcast for book lovers, I've asked my guest to recommend two books, one from his field and one personal choice. What have you chosen?
Yeah, obviously I have a lot of books I could recommend. One is by Felsenthal and Normi. In 2019, they have written a book about voting procedures on the restricted domain, an examination of the invulnerability of 20 voting procedures to 5 main paradoxes. So they summarize everything what we know somehow on voting, on the election procedures, which go well, which don't go well, what are the problems, and what might be good ones from the existing ones. So that is, from my own field, a very nicely done book. And the other one, I still would recommend to read again, in some sense, maybe A Beautiful Mind, a biography of John Forbes Nash, by Sylvia Nasar. That's still one of my favorite books, exactly. And we can always read it again.
Okay. Well, today I've been talking to Hans Gersbach, author of Redesigning Democracy, published by Springer. Thanks again for coming on, Hans.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.